Red State at WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Delta Township officials and residents must feel good today about the possibility of 400 new jobs. Canadian auto parts supplier Norplaz wants to open a 350,000 square foot facility, what they describe as a state-of-the-art robotic paint line and injection molding plant near GM's Delta Township plant. This is from Laura Misjak's treatment of the story in this morning's State Journal. Apologies if I'm mispronouncing your name, Laura. One other thing that jumped out at me in the story was a stat buried, well, I won't say buried, but fairly late in the story. A company official reportedly told MEDC, that's the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, that Norplaz's parent company expects to add more than 4,000 jobs in the next 4 years, and 90 to 95% of them here in Michigan. So that was also a part of that story. And I wonder if that will somehow make its way into Mayor Virge Brunero's State of the City address next Monday night. The mayor has a regional orientation toward the economy and service sharing and consolidation. And if I were a betting man, I'd say yes. We'll just have to wait and see. City leaders in East Lansing are about to begin discussions on the next city budget. Fiscal year 2014 is almost here, and development, housing, and other issues are among others that are confronting East Lansing leaders. And here to talk about all of that, East Lansing City Manager George Lahannis and the city's Director of Planning, Building, and Development, Tim Dempsey. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, still not too late to say that, I hope. We're launching into another budget process for fiscal year 2014. How challenging do you expect it to be this spring, and what costs and what revenues are in play here, George?
Well, you know, we're actually in Michigan coming at the end of about 10 years of very difficult times for city government. We've had decreasing revenues from state share revenue, which is the state government redistributing sales taxes back to cities. So we've had quite a tough time now in Michigan. All local governments have had that situation. East Lansing, we're, you know, no different, though we've been, I think, doing a very responsible job of tightening our belts all along, controlling costs through paring back the size of our workforce. We saw the results of that this past fall in our audit from last year, where we see that the city actually added to our general fund reserves by a modest amount, which means to me and certainly to our auditors that we were controlling costs even in the face of declining revenues. We're just at the start of our budget process now. We are several months away from having a full budget prepared and approved by council. But what we really do over the next couple of weeks is sit down with the city council, let them see a five-year forecast and the budget really thrown together in its first form. Then there's lots of opportunities for public input. Our residents have a chance to come in over numerous meetings, public meetings, to give input on the budget, what they value, what they want to see. And so at this point, it's too soon to tell. We'll know better in a week or two. But I think that the message will likely be the same. We'll continue controlling costs. We've had some assistance from our residents in terms of a library millage that helps the general fund and the library. So I would say we are cautiously optimistic and see some positive signs on the horizon.
Now, most cities and municipalities face long-term pension and health care deficits, though. Does East Lansing?
Yes, East Lansing in that respect. I would say cities of a certain size, so when you get to a certain type of organization, and East Lansing would fall into that, cities that have been in existence for a while that provide police and fire services and at a certain population have what we would term as legacy costs. They have provided defined benefit pensions, and they provided a promise of health care at retirement to employees over the past 30 or 40 years. And as your organization tends to shrink over the last 10 years, as I mentioned, those benefits get quite costly because you simply have less people working, more people retired over time, and that becomes a burden both to pay for the health care and the pension.
You got a number you can attach to that? I mean, a 30-year number or something like that?
There are actually numbers of health care where the city has an obligation of perhaps $40 to $44 million unfunded 4 years ago. We have been making our payments on that over the past 4 years of $1.6 million. So we haven't had the exact number with market returns yet, but I would say we are close to having funded at $7 million or more of that unfunded liability. So that's going from zero to $7 million over 4 years. So we think we're moving that very much in the right direction.
But with 30-some million to go
unfunded.
Over the long haul.
And that's payment that we would need to make over the next, like you mentioned, 25 years.
Right.
So that presents a challenge to us, as it does to many other cities. It really has been, for us, the private sector got that strong message about these unfunded liabilities in the early 90s, and you saw significant changes. Those changes came in accounting practices to local governments in the late 90s or early 2000s, when we started to actually have to recognize not just what we're spending in the current year to pay for those benefits, but recognize the long-term obligation. So that's what you're getting at. We've displayed those numbers, and we're working at them in a responsible manner to make progress.
Tim Dempsey, what's the latest? We're talking with George Lahannis, East Lansing City Manager, and Tim Dempsey, the city's Director of Planning, Building, and Development. Tim, what's the latest regarding the Grand River Abbott Road properties? I know a plan for 2 four-story buildings is apparently on the table for what is now 100 through 140 West Grand River, mixed use, but some unpaid taxes are a hurdle. Who owes whom? How much, I guess?
Sure. The properties that you're talking about that are in question, there are taxes owed to the city. There was a question raised whether or not they could proceed with the application. We do have a requirement in the city charter where we essentially cannot approve or move forward on agreements with people that are owing in back taxes. However, a site plan application is not defined as a contract. So you got a site plan,
but not a contract.
Correct.
Okay.
We do not have a development agreement on this particular project anymore. If I could give a little bit of context on the whole project.
Please.
We had a 5-acre redevelopment site under the City Center 2 project. And then in June of last year, when our city council decided not to proceed with the developer, what we did, the city decided to look at issuing a request for proposals and qualifications for about the 2.5 acres that the city controls. So we've done that. Those are due on February 8th. That's kind of what we're referring to as our Park District planning area. And then the properties that were in private ownership are the ones that have been advanced for redevelopment, primarily the 2 buildings that are right on Grand River, as well as the old Evergreen Arms apartment along Evergreen. That's a separate kind of proposal to just rehab that apartment building. So that's the project that's going through the process and had the issue with the taxes that you mentioned.
Now, is Strathmore Development and Scott Chappelle the developer here, or is this a subsidiary of Strathmore?
There's actually 2 development entities that are involved, Cata Investment and City Center 2 Properties. They're both LLCs. There's a different controlling interest besides Mr. Chappelle. The project's actually been represented by Bergman and Associates. They're the agent representative of that ownership entity.
Now, some activists in East Lansing allege a lack of transparency in addition to unpaid taxes that dates back some years. Is there anything to these allegations as far as you're concerned?
No, I think we've been very forthcoming in this new RFQP process. One of the things that we did before we even issued it was we had a series of community forums where we got the community together to give us input on that process. What did they want to see? How should we structure this RFQP? We had a lot of public input, and our city council and our downtown development authority utilized that input to adjust that RFQP accordingly. As far as the current proposal that's going forward, that's going through our standard site plan review process. We've had public hearings at the Planning Commission level. We'll be having those at the City Council level. City Council has already discussed these projects at a work session. So I think we've been very open about what's on the table in terms of the project, and we're going to be certainly engaging the public even further on the RFQP process as that moves forward.
George Lahannis, any thoughts on the future of the corner of Grand River and Abbott Road?
Well, as Mr. Dempsey said, I mean, we can control what we can control, and that's our portion of the land, the 5.5 acres that the city and the DDA have control over. We're optimistic that next month we'll be getting some hopefully very exciting proposals from developers that can look at our portion of the property. As to what happens exactly on the corner, if that's controlled by another entity, as you mentioned, the City Center 2 and CATA, and they have an application, then the city will give that due consideration and move. Then that will move forward through the process as it's justified. But at this point, I think we're particularly excited about the portion of land that we control. And that's where we're looking for developers to partner with to see what great things can come with that.
Sharing Fire Chief Randy Talaferro with Lansing appears to be working out. The city okayed another year-long sharing agreement. Can you comment on that?
Sure. You know, obviously the city of Lansing and all of our regional partners, whether it's Meridian Township, Lansing Township, Delhi, and Delta, have all been working on a fire shared services study. That study started about a year and a half ago and looked at how these six regional departments could provide more efficient fire services to our residents. The chief situation came out of that essentially where Lansing stood to have their chief retire. And in order to sort of facilitate and support the study, they said, well, let's see if we can share East Lansing's chief. And we believe we have an excellent chief in Chief Randy Talaferro. So we agreed to certainly work with our neighbor and share his services with them for this past year. We've been working on this sort of look at how we can improve automatic mutual aid, how we can make fire services better for all of our residents. And I really see that having a shared chief running the two largest departments in the region during that study does nothing but help that. It really helps us sort of unify our approach, standardize policies, if you will, standardize responses. So doing it for this additional year makes sense for us, makes sense for Lansing.
You think you're ever going back to a separate fire chief? I mean, do you have a feeling on that?
I did talk to City Council about that during our work session where we said that it is not our intent to continue this current structure into perpetuity. The chief cannot do the work of two people. So we're getting a little less fire chief than we need because he spends half his time at the city of Lansing and half his time at East Lansing. We're okay with that for the short term because we're working towards a greater goal of greater collaboration amongst all of our departments, which will hopefully serve us into the future very well. But to ask one person to serve for two separate departments continually isn't fair to Chief Talaferro and doesn't give him the ability to do his job with the way he would want to do it.
How long would you want to continue with this arrangement?
Well, what I'm thinking is that, and what we've discussed with Chief Talaferro and Council, is that there has to be some permanent structure put in place at some point, some sort of a shared administration where we do that on a permanent basis, where the leadership of our department and Lansing and perhaps more departments is structured that way on a permanent basis. Perhaps there are assistant chiefs that answer to Chief Talaferro, that there's a unified command structure, but that where that chief's administration simply administers multiple departments.
Are we moving closer to a plan like that, though? I mean,
that's one of the possibilities where you would continue to maintain separate departments. So we would have an East Lansing Fire Department, the City of Lansing would have their fire department with their employees and their names on the trucks. But one possible model of working together is that you have a shared fire administration so that your police chief and your fire chief and your fire inspection or fire training come out of one unified command. So that is a possibility. That is an example of the type of thing we would want to see over the coming years, because otherwise, if you were to have a chief serving two departments, it makes sense if they were in the midst of a recruitment process, but they are not actively recruiting a chief to our understanding, and both of us are simply waiting to see how this study develops and how beneficial it can be to partner more in administration.
The city council's looking at a proposal involving homeowners that got the approval of your housing commissioner. Pardon me. This would enable homeowners who are having trouble selling their homes to rent their properties for a couple of years, and if I'm not mistaken, to extend that beyond 2 years, if that's possible. Now, resistance from community members got the proposal, I believe, sent back to the Housing Commission for more consideration. What's at the heart of this discussion?
Well, really at the heart of this discussion is the Housing Commission wants to take a look at what they can do to possibly help people who are in the midst of trying to sell their house, but due to the obvious market conditions that are rather tough all around the country, to give people some measure of relief that they can look to rent their house for a very fixed period of time under certain conditions. That did get a lot of good input at the city council meeting. That's the point of the public process, is to bring something forward, have a public hearing, hear what your residents feel about something, and that happened. And I think we had very good participation, which was useful for council. They then kicked it back to Housing Commission for further discussion and consideration. So just because the council is talking about it doesn't mean it will move forward in that format. The Housing Commission will have a second look at it, and perhaps come back with some tweaks and recommendations to council.
We've just got a few seconds. Tell us about the Emerging Leaders program in East Lansing.
That is a really exciting program for us. We have a sort of overall really strong commitment to citizen engagement. We think it's the right thing to do, and we think it is the smart thing to do. It's right because as a local government, we want lots of involved citizens. It's good for democracy. It's the smart thing to do because it leads to better policy and better outcomes and better buy-in from residents. The East Lansing Emerging Leaders is a part of that. It's taking people who have an interest in government and really letting them know a whole lot about how their city government operates, and hopefully they'll be the people who want to serve in neighborhood organizations, neighborhood associations, on boards and commissions, perhaps even city council. So for us, it's like a citizen academy. It's getting people excited about local government and excited about participating in their local government. So for us, it's a great opportunity.
And more information at cityofeastlansing.org, I would imagine.
Cityofeastlansing.com. Tomorrow is the end of the registration. We're just about full on people, but if people have an interest, please apply.
East Lansing City Manager George Lahannis and East Lansing Director of Planning, Building, and Development Tim Dempsey, many thanks, guys.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Its current state on WKAR, a report published this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association documents how healthcare professionals in Lansing and 13 other communities across the country are working to reduce hospital readmission rates among Medicare patients. Experts say about 20% of all Medicare patients who are discharged from hospitals across the country return for more treatment within 30 days. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services say these rehospitalizations cost billions of dollars each year, and many are avoidable. And I'm joined now by WKAR's Kevin Lavery, who's been looking into this study and what it means for the healthcare system. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Mark. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. This is an interesting story that focused on Lansing. What was the point of the study and who was involved?
Well, first of all, this study was led by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, a national organization. This organization gave funding to 14 separate what are called QIOs. These are Medicare Quality Improvement Organizations. Every state has one. In Michigan, it's a group that's called MPRO, and they're based in Farmington Hills. Again, 14 communities, cities large and small, medium-sized cities, from Lansing to Evansville, Indiana, Tuscaloosa, Alabama, to Denver and Miami. So a pretty good mix of market sizes. MPRO chose Lansing to be its study market, and that involved the region's two large hospitals, Sparrow and McLaren of Greater Lansing, plus just a host of healthcare providers, home healthcare, hospice care, assisted living groups. And it was a study that actually ran for 3 years. It ended in 2011, from 2008 to 2011. And the whole point was to find out how the community's healthcare provider network could develop a common strategy for preventing Medicare patients from being readmitted to hospitals within 30 days of their original discharge. And much of this focus was on what's called care transitions. That's the idea of moving people seamlessly from one setting to another, whether you're coming out of the hospital, back to your home, or to a skilled nursing facility, making sure there's consistency all across the way.
To avoid the readmission.
That's right.
Hopefully. Now, why do Medicare beneficiaries have such a high, they call it a bounce rate, once they're discharged from a hospital?
Well, typically these are people who have severe chronic illnesses. Very often we see people with diabetes, congestive heart failure. As a matter of fact, heart failure patients tend to be the among the higher groups, percentage groups who have this readmission rate. Frankly, they lack resources. Often they can't afford their medications. Sometimes they'll just get a sudden condition that lands them in the hospital. When they come home, they sometimes don't have good support or direction about what to do. So there's a communication aspect from provider to patient and even between providers that is sometimes inconsistent. I spoke with Dr. Dennis Perry about this. He is a physician in Okemos in private practice, and he is also the medical director at Burcham Hills Retirement Center in East Lansing. So he's on the front lines of this. And here's what Dr. Perry says about that.
The biggest thing I think that gets talked about that's a reality in our system is that we have a lot of silos of care. You go to the hospital and you get fantastic care from the hospital. You go to a subacute rehab and you get excellent care from the folks there. You go home and you've got your family doctor or internist to look after you, but we don't connect those dots. And so there's a lot of errors that occur that end up in a readmission.
So what are some of the adverse effects of rehospitalization then, Kevin?
Certainly, Mark, certainly it's inconvenient for the person who thought initially everything was under control and now they've come back in for inpatient care because of some misunderstanding or confusion about their treatment regimen. Really, it's expensive. Speaking with MPRO about this, they tell me about 20% of Medicare patients discharged from hospitals are readmitted. That number really is about 25%, as we mentioned before, with heart failure patients, rather. This costs our national healthcare system, you can read that as we the taxpayers, about $26 billion a year. And it's quite a bureaucracy. Healthcare is a complex, fragmented process these days. It's very costly.
So what are local healthcare providers doing to try to curb the problem?
Dr. Perry from Burcham Hills says one thing they've tried in Lansing is what they call a congestive heart failure passport. And this harkens back to the notion that heart patients are especially at risk. Essentially, it's a booklet that the providers give to the patients as an educational tool. It gives them a way to track their medications and relays pertinent pieces of their health history to the next provider on down the line, whether that's in a hospital or a home setting, even hospice care. Constantly, this passport gets upgraded, just like a real passport, that where you document where you've been, what services were performed at that location. It's a good way to keep the information flow going. It's not as good as an electronic medical record system, which many larger urban communities have, but Dr. Perry says that's really just that's a few years off for us in the Lansing area. Here's really the key, though, to the study. After 3 years of these coordinated interventions, Lansing reported a more than 4% reduction in rehospitalizations after 30 days, and that has saved the Medicare program about $3 million.
Wow. Not insignificant.
Not at all.
That's very good. Now, in October, the federal government announced it would impose penalties on hospitals that see really high rehospitalization rates. Has that had some impact here in Michigan?
It has. Not really in the Lansing area, though. I don't really understand or know what the threshold rate is for that. But I'm told that hospitals could lose up to 1% of their Medicare income. The people who've participated in the study here in Lansing are very proud of the savings that they've achieved because that funding goes right back into the pool for Medicare beneficiaries. The 4% reduction is a step in the right direction.
Excellent. Good stuff, Kevin. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Current state here on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. You can reach us with your segment ideas, story ideas, feedback of any sort here just by emailing us. It's currentstate@wkar.org. We're glad you're here. The North American International Auto Show takes place at Detroit's Cobo Hall all this week. Now, during last week's press review, WKAR's Peter Worf checked out the latest models and new car technology. Peter stopped by the General Motors area to zero in on Chevrolet's electric vehicles. Anne-Marie Damon is a North American International Auto Show product specialist, and she was Peter's tour guide for a discussion of Chevy's new Spark. That's the updated Chevy Volt.
There are a few changes. If you're looking at the roof of the vehicle, it no longer has that shiny black roof. People were kind of mistaking that for solar panels for us, so it now has actually a body-colored roof. On the interior, you've got some different options there as well, and it now actually has a center armrest in the rear seat. It's actually a removable armrest, kind of convenient, so if you do still want to use that rear hatch space for larger items for cargo holding, you have a little more space there, but you still have the option of the armrest as well.
Are we looking at any new developments or differences in actual battery run time and distance?
Previous years, it had been a 35-mile EPA estimated range. It's now a 38-mile estimated range. And one of the other things they've done is that you now have the choice of whether you want to go onto battery mode immediately or go on to that extended range generator mode. So there's actually a button on it now that you can press and say you want to, say you know you're going to be driving around a city for about 40 miles in the day, but you have a freeway drive to get there. You can put it onto EV hold mode, go directly onto the generator, and save your battery power for when you get to the city.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Appreciate it.
And
what about
the Spark?
Yeah,
EV
absolutely.
Well?
Yeah, you bet.
We don't have the EV here. We had it the first couple of press days. We've moved it now,
okay.
But it would be just like this little guy over here, the little green one. So
okay.
If you want to go stand by that one, we can do that. But it's a fully plug-in electric.
Well, Anne-Marie, tell us what we're looking at here and how this sort of compares and contrasts with a Volt.
All right. Well, this is the Spark EV. Well, the one we're actually looking at here is the regular Spark. This is just our mini car for the 2014 model year, summer of 2013, California and Oregon. We are going to have a fully plug-in electric version of the Spark. It's called the Spark EV. So unlike the Volt, it does not have that backup extended range system on it, but it does have a larger distance that you're expected to get on the battery. From what they're telling us, it is going to be among the best in its class, which means you're going to have a range of upwards of 80 miles on a single charge. It will charge in either a 120 or a 240 at home. 240 charging time is anticipated to be under 7 hours, so it should be pretty easy overnight charging for you. And it will be the first vehicle in the industry to use a DC SAE fast charge, which will bring the battery to 80% of its total capacity in 20 minutes. So kind of a game changer as far as electric vehicles go.
That's an amazingly quick charge-up speed.
Yes, it is the kind of thing that allows you to take a little rest stop, get yourself a snack, stretch your legs, continue on to wherever you're going without having to sit down for several hours will hopefully get people a little more comfortable with the idea of an electric car as their only vehicle.
Is part of this more of an entry level as compared with a Volt?
It is definitely a little more entry level. It is a smaller vehicle. Like I said, it would be in the mini car segment, whereas the Volt is a compact. So you've got less room in there. It's still a four-seater. You actually have a surprising amount of headroom in this one. You still have some good cargo room in there as well. But it's a simpler vehicle than the Volt. The Volt is definitely our more upscale electric at this point.
Anne-Marie, thanks very much for an update on the Volt and a look at the new Spark.
You're very welcome.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
What's the red one? Is that
the red one's a plain Spark as well. So these are both just the plain ones. I don't know why they decided to take the EV away, but maybe because...
Current State on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. Brian Calloway covers MSU women's and men's basketball and other areas for the Lansing State Journal. We welcome Brian to Current State. How are you?
I'm not too bad. How are you guys doing?
We're just great. Bring us up to speed on the MSU women's team and how they're doing. I know they're ranked now, 25th, just barely, but ranked, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, this week they got into the rankings for the very first time. They're off to a 16-2 start, which matches the best 18-game start in program history. And they've really done it with their defense. I mean, they are in the top five in the nation in scoring defense, so they're holding opponents to about 47.4 points per game. Also, I mean, they've held every team's leading scorer that they've played under their season average as well, too. So it's been a pretty successful season for them at doing that so far. And, I mean, this success necessarily wasn't expected just because of all the injuries and adversity this team has faced this season. They've had Kiana Johnson and Akaya Taylor, two of their bench players right now. They served 9-game suspensions at the start of the season. Also had Madison Williams, who was a McDonald's All-American in our recruiting class a couple years ago. She's out for the third straight year with an ACL injury. Ariel Powers tore her Achilles tendon before the season, and she's a highly talented freshman. And then Brandy Agee, another freshman that played a few games for them this season, she also tore her ACL in December. So, I mean, they've had a lot of pieces go down and been without a lot of these pieces for most of the season and have still been achieving the success that they have.
So you got to wonder what they're going to do if they're when everybody's healthy.
Yeah, it should
is
be.
Is that the deal?
Yeah, it should be interesting next year when she has all these players healthy. And, I mean, they only lose two players, Courtney Schiffauer, who's one of the senior captains, and Jasmine Thomas, who's a senior guard. They've played a lot this season, but those are the only two they lose, really. So it should be interesting to see what Susie will do next year. And she also has a highly talented recruit coming in, Tori Jankowska. She's from Freeland High School. She's a Miss Basketball candidate this year. She's averaging over 30 points a game this season, and she's done a pretty good job there at Freeland.
You profile a redshirt freshman on the team in this morning's State Journal, Akaya Taylor. What's Akaya's role on this team?
Akaya, ever since she's kind of come back from her suspension, she's been one of those – she's added some depth off the bench. I mean, before when she was out, they were pretty much only playing six players, with Jasmine Hines being the main component off the bench. But now, you know, Kiana Johnson and Akaya have come back and to provide some much-needed help off the bench. And Akaya's season has been kind of interesting just for the fact that she was out with the suspension, and then she was out with various illnesses. She had a battle of MRSA twice this year. So
I don't know anybody who's had it twice.
Yeah.
That it was really something.
Yeah, very, very surprising. And, I mean, she said she's got her – I talked to her yesterday. She said she has her medications under control, and she feels like that she's kind of getting back to where she needs to be healthy. So, I mean – she's coming off her best game as a Spartan. She had 7 points off the bench in Sunday's win over Indiana. And she had scored 7 points all season prior to that.
Wow. What were the suspensions about?
Just a violation of NCAA rules of receipt of extra benefits.
Receipt of extra benefits.
Yeah.
Okay, but that's all behind them.
Yeah, hopefully. All behind them.
Now, Coach Susie Merchant, I see, according to your article, says that Akaya is sometimes a little too aggressive. She's really athletic and sometimes a little too aggressive.
Yes, I mean, she plays with a bundle of energy, which is definitely needed and provides a spark off the bench. But,
yeah.
You know, sometimes, you know, gets a little too aggressive. But she's really played under control these past few games here. And Sunday, she really gave them some valuable minutes. I mean, Susie talked about it in her press conference on Monday that you're kind of getting into the grind of January. And she could tell that her players who were playing a lot with, you know, those two suspensions and all the injuries, I mean, they kind of needed someone to step up and provide a lift off the bench. And Akaya Taylor and Kiana Johnson both did that on Sunday, I believe. They combined for 22 points in that win over Indiana.
Hmm. We're talking with the Lansing State Journal's Brian Calloway about MSU women's and men's basketball and a few other things. Does the women's team have a postseason future? It sounds like they do.
Yes, they do. Actually, Charlie Cream, who's a bracketologist for ESPN, he has them slated as a 6th seed for the NCAA tournament in his latest projections.
And excellent.
Yeah, so they would be playing. He has them slated to play in College Park, which is one of the regions hosting.
How is attendance at the women's games?
The women have drawn very good this season. I mean, their success obviously has helped tremendously. But, I mean, they're getting in the four to 5,000 a night, and they're expecting another big crowd on Sunday. It's their Girl Scout game, and they also have a nationally televised game on ESPN2 against number 15 Purdue. So that should also help bring some fans in the stands as well, too.
Are there fans that have kind of adopted the women's team that may not go to a men's game very often but are like at every women's game?
Yes. I mean, I see a lot of the same people all the time. And I mean, they're very into the game and very into this team. And I think a lot of it is, too, that, you know, they kind of feel like a personal connection to this team just because, you know, Susie Merchant's out in the community. This team's out in the community kind of selling themselves, too. And I actually just talked to Susie kind of a little bit about this for a piece I'm working on later in a couple next month about just the growth of women's basketball. But it seems like, you know, the older crowd and a lot of the younger kids are kind of the market that's attracted to this women's basketball team.
Hmm. You think Coach Merchant is here for a good long time?
Yeah, I mean, I think she's done a nice job building this program up and kind of taking off where previous Joanne P. Left this program. So, yeah, she's here for the long haul, I believe.
Now, let's switch gears a little bit. Remind us who Drake Harris is and what relevance he has to the MSU sports program.
Yeah, Drake Harris is a junior student athlete at Grand Rapids Christian High School. Had a huge monster football season this fall, helped lead Grand Rapids Christian to the Division III state title. And, I mean, he sets the state record for receiving yards and had a state record performance in the championship game as well, too. But he committed over the summer to Michigan State for both football and basketball. Recently, he's come out and said that he will only play football in college, and he's kind of started to attract a lot more offers. Just the other day, he tweeted that he got an offer from Alabama, and they were in his school visiting him. He also got an offer from Ohio State last week as well, too. So he's kind of been a guy that's really blowing up here, and it's someone that Michigan State's going to have to fight to keep.
When would he announce?
Well, he actually announced over the summer he verbally committed
to Michigan State.
Yes, but he can sign not next year, next February. It will be when he can officially sign to a school. So there's still a whole year left for him, for other schools to kind of get in on him and try to woo him away from Michigan State. And I mean, this is a kid that recently was named, Tom Lemming, he's a football recruiting guru, named him the top receiver in the nation for the class of 2014. So he's a kid that his stock is very high right now, and he's going to attract a lot of offers. And obviously you see Urban Meyer from Ohio State, you know, Nick Saban from Alabama, and other schools trying to get in on him. So.
And what kind of senior year is he going to have if he had a junior year like that?
Yeah, I mean, he's...
This could be off the charts.
Yes.
Well, Drake Harris, we'll keep an eye on that situation. How long have you been at the Lansing State Journal then?
I've been there since October of 2010. So I started as a sports copy editor, but have kind of transitioned into a role of reporting last April.
Your dream job to write sports?
Oh, yes.
A print job?
Yeah, I've always, even when I was in high school, I mean, I knew that I wanted to be a sports reporter. So, I mean, it's just a dream to be able to do this.
That's great. Now, where do you come from? Where'd you grow up?
Originally from Coloma, Michigan, which is just outside of Benton Harbor, pretty much right on the shores of Lake Michigan.
All right. The Deer Park,
yeah.
Right? The Coloma Deer Park.
Yeah,
I went
Deer
there
Forest.
As a kid. Deer Forest. That was it. I was there when you like your beat, though, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah. You want to stay with, over the long haul, do you expect to stay with basketball or move to football? Or what would you like to do?
Well, I actually do a little bit of football. I do stuff with football recruiting and also do some stuff with the football team as well, too, usually at all the home games and some of the away games for football as well, too. So.
You'd like to be a two-sport guy, though?
Yeah.
Like Drake Harris. You're a two-sport guy.
Yeah.
Well, Brian Calloway, we appreciate your time for bringing us up to speed on the women's program in particular, but the other stuff as well.
No problem.
Who doesn't know that song? I dare anybody to raise their hand who is listening right now who does not know Money by Pink Floyd. Lansing's Happen Dance Dance Company performs an innovative program this weekend. It presents an original choreography to the music of Pink Floyd's legendary 1973 album, The Dark Side of the Moon. And there's a preview performance tonight and others tomorrow and Saturday nights at LCC's Dart Auditorium. Happy to welcome the founder and executive director of Happen Dance, Diane Newman, to WKAR, along with incoming executive director, Missy Lilje. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
You.
This sounds like a fun production, but I want to start with you, Diane. A lot of people have attended Happen Dance performances and classes over the years. This is your last performance as executive director, I understand?
It's my last year, yes.
Your last year. You've been at this for a long time. What are you thinking and feeling as you step down from this position?
Oh, I'm actually rather ambivalent about it, having been a founder in 1976 and still being here 37 years later. It's a wonderful legacy to look back on, to know how many people have helped and all. But first I was the artistic director for the first 15 years. Then I moved into a little bit different role and allowed other people to have that experience of artistic directing. And I moved into executive directing about 17 years ago, which means I had to actually learn to write grants and do all the administrative tasks of a business. And that was very exciting for me. I felt like that was another area that I grew in. But I am ready at this time in my life, after 37 years of this wonderful organization, to explore some other things about myself and about my world. And And so I'm excited to know that it's someone like Missy who is going to take that role on.
Missy, tell us about your idea to design a performance around Dark Side of the Moon. I imagine you're a longtime fan of the music.
Yes, I am. And although I'm not old enough to have learned of it when it first came out.
You probably had an older brother, if I know how this typically
is.
Yes,
yes.
Melissa,
exactly.
She does.
Who is our lighting designer.
Melissa, if you were cool, you'd be listening to
this.
That's
right, okay? Yes. And so it's always been a favorite of mine. And as you age, some of the things that you liked when you were young fall away, and others really stand the test of time, and you feel this is a real classic thing. And millions upon millions of people agree with me about that, about Dark Side of the Moon, as shown by its record sales.
It's unbelievable. I don't think there's an album that compares to it, really, in terms of longevity.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
It was like a top five album for years.
Yes.
I mean, it was just amazing. Yes. Diane, what did you think of the idea?
I was excited about it because I am old enough to to have actually listened to that music, and so I'm very excited with the with the outcome of how she's interpreted it and put it out there for the community to access it in a different way than just the music, but in terms of dance as an art. So.
Did you all feel the transition to dance would work?
Oh yes.
You like the idea once you.
Yeah, I
could. Yes.
Yeah. When I'm putting my kids to bed, sometimes I lay down with them, and in the quiet, it goes in through my head, and I just see dance in my head to this music.
Yeah.
And
Missy, did you struggle designing movement to any of the music on Dark Side of the Moon?
Any color.
I kind of feel your pain listening to that here for the first time in a long time.
Only track on the entire album that doesn't have a human voice. Well, I guess you can hear the guitar player's voice a little bit as he sings along, as he plays and improvises.
And the track was a track called Any Color You Like, by the way.
Yes, yeah. So. I kept saying, if I could remove one of these tracks, it would be this one, because I can't figure out what to do in my storyline here. And there's no lyric to guide me. And so I pretty much finished the whole thing and skipped that part. And then I asked my mentor, Diane, and other folks that I trusted, what do you think should go here? And got a lot of really valuable feedback that helped.
See, now people who are listening to this are going to attend the performance, and they're going to hear that music, and they're going to really pay attention.
Yes.
And know, wow, she really struggled with this.
Yes, I did.
How many performers are in this?
20, a total of 20. We have five professionals, three apprentices, and 12 student dancers that are part of our student company called Happen Dance 2.
And one of them is my niece, Allison Rhodes. I got to drop
that
in.
Nice connection.
How many of the younger kids were aware of this music before the rehearsals started? I got it.
Two or three of them.
Okay. It's finally.
They're way too young.
But see, she's prompting the next generation of lovers of Dark Side of the Moon.
Well, I guess so. We're growing another generation. Is that it?
It's not hard. Once they hear it, it's not hard.
We're talking with Missy Lilje and Diane Newman of Lansing's Happen Dance Dance Company. They perform an original performance to the music of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon tonight and the next two nights. This has to be a great way to get people who might never consider to attending a modern dance concert to actually attend, assuming they like Dark Side of the Moon, because even if they end up not caring for the dance, God forbid, there's the music, right?
That's right. We're cheating.
But that really is one of Missy's strengths. Having come out of her master's program, she was really investigating what it takes to make a dance company, a small regional dance company, sustainable. And her goal has often been to make it more relevant to the community, to draw them in through something they're already appreciating, and then expand them by exposing them to the art of dance. So I think this is just a wonderful outcome of that.
Yeah. Now, Missy, you referred to Diane as your mentor. So you two go back.
Mm-hmm. We go way back.
Yeah.
She came to us at 7 years old to have an it school.
7 years old.
7 years
okay.
Old.
Oh, my God.
But then she left and got a major, a bachelor's in at University of Michigan in dance, and then went on to get her master's at Arizona State.
How
so
exciting.
She's left the community, but she comes back, and she knows the Happen Dance philosophy and what we've built here, and is just so poised to have the information and the talent and the passion to carry on after me. So,
what is the Happen Dance philosophy?
The dance is accessible and important and natural for people to explore. People are moving in the womb before they ever come out and learn to speak or draw or any of the other things. They're hearing a heartbeat. They're kicking. Movement is natural to the human. And
that dance,
this goes on.
Dance is a great vehicle to promote your self-knowledge. It doesn't, you know, as at the Happen Dance School, we're so proud of all of our graduating students, whether they become dancers or not. We hope they're more empowered individuals, more actualized people that can go out into the world and be better versions of themselves for having danced.
Wow, that's a lofty mission to have. You have compared, here in our conversations that we've had already, Missy, you've compared Happen Dance to dance troupes, that the caliber of dance that you'll see at Happen Dance, to the quality of dance that you would see in much bigger cities. How has that unfolded?
Well, as Diane mentioned, I went to a top 10 dance program for undergrad and one that was ranked third in the country for grad school. And so dance companies would come in that are, you know, the greatest and the best of our time and historical icons I've been able to study with and see up close and been able to tour the country with some other professional dance companies I've been with and in presenting at conferences and such, going overseas. And I just keep coming back to Happen Dance and going, well, these dancers are just as good. I mean, they have the same level of training as all of those people, yet people in Lansing don't seem to know that, maybe because they live and work right here.
I have had that very thought so many times because my niece Allison has performed with Children's Ballet mm-hmm. Theater and
yes.
Happen Dance and,
right.
and really all of the local troupes and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And I'm not a dance guy. I wasn't a dance guy until Allison and Caitlin got involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been blown away. My head has really been turned. So that is from the heart.
That's so nice.
That's not just the family connection. That is mm-hmm. really a statement about the caliber of the performances that you all put together. So you've got a preview performance tonight. Will people be able to get into that? You haven't sold
Absolutely.
Tickets to that.
The preview performance tonight is by donation.
Okay.
So pay what you can. Come on in. And then tomorrow and Saturday, $12 to $15 for tickets. And we just hope that everyone can come on out.
I think it's going to be a good time. Happen Dance in Lansing and The Dark Side of the Moon tonight and the next couple of nights at Dart Auditorium at Lansing Community College. Diane Newman, best of luck to you. Many thanks. Missy Lilje, good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.